agreed to talk about it. As much as we are of breaking lines and breaking lines.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I think this talk is going to be slightly different with respect to the others, in the sense that the emphasis is on cosmology. So some of the things I'm going to say, some of the models I'm going to present, are going to satisfy rigor in a different sense from particle physics, necessarily. So what I will consider self-consistent is probably not quite the same. I will be reviewing theories which are very radical and theories which are very conservative. But in both cases, what I will try and do is show you the payoff, the cosmological payoff, from actually doing such a radical thing as breaking Lorentz invariance, diffeomorphism invariance, breaking everything that moves. That's what I'm going to be doing. So it looks like, indeed, the universe is begging for this to be done. This was already said. The universe seems to be breaking Lorentz, or at least have a preferred frame. So it looks like the universe more generally is begging because of its problems, which I'm going to mention, is begging for these symmetries to be broken. I was expecting initially that the advantage of this approach over, for example, inflation, would be that there would be more direct tests. So things which you could test without necessarily going through the whole baggage of cosmology, which means a lot of assumptions which may not be completely justified. But anyway, that hasn't been so successful more recently, so I will be sticking to cosmology. So just to begin, let's not get tangled. I don't want to spend too long on this slide. Don't jump on me immediately. But it's important to stress that when you say Lorentz invariance, there are really two postulates there, relativity and constancy of the speed of light, and they are independent things. And likewise, when you talk about curved spacetime, there's local Lorentz invariance and there's diffeomorphism invariance. And particularly if you use the Palatini-Cartan approach, there's two kinds of indices, and you can screw things up in one and not the other. They're really independent things. So when discussing theories which violate these invariances, you can mix and match at will. You can have theories in which you have preferred frames, but a constant speed of light, in which you have a varying speed of light, but not constant frames, and in which you break both. There's two independent things, and you can choose which one to break or not. In curved spacetime, likewise, you can break local Lorentz invariance, but not diffeomorphism invariance, and vice versa. Or, since you're at it, you might as well break everything. Okay? But you have a choice between these various things, and you should bear that in mind. The emphasis of this talk is going to be on theories which have a varying speed of light, one way or another. And I will be reviewing crazy things with or without preferred frames, with or without diffeomorphism invariance. There's varying speed of light doesn't mean anything. It's an umbrella term for quite a few classes of theories. I will be showing you some very radical things and some very conservative things. The focus is going to be applications to cosmology. And I'm going to be reviewing things which have something to say about the horizon and flatness problem. And this is really like cosmologists in the pub. Okay, you'll see that it's not really serious. This is serious. Primordial fluctuations is really when cosmology is a serious science. And I'll be discussing that. Okay, so there's been some history, and this kind of every now and then in this, all these talks here have gone into the historical background. Here's the pedigree of this field. It's actually quite respectable. It's this gentleman, Paul Dirac, who in the 1930s started off the field of varying constants. And I like this quote very much. It's a beautiful quote. "One field of work in which there has been too much speculation is cosmology. Its models are probably all wrong," very up to date, I think. Comment. "It is usually assumed that the laws of nature have always been the same as they are now. There is no justification for this. In particular, quantities which are considered to be constants of nature may be varying with cosmological time." So what Dirac is alerting us to is the massive extrapolation there is of going from physics tested here and now to the Big Bang. It may not be justified. It is a very deep quote. It is even addressing the possibility of variability in the constants of nature. More about this in a bit later. So one thing which is not pointed out very often is that Dirac wrote this paper during his honeymoon. It's not on record what his wife thought about this. just to compound matters, she was actually Wigner's sister. So you know, things were really in the family somehow. Anyway, he wrote this paper, which I think is very radical, and opened up this whole can of worms of variability in the laws of physics and in the constants of nature. It was very badly received at the time. This is what Niels Bohr said. "Look what happens to people when they get married." And a few Years later, actually, this guy Dingell in Nature referred to all these approaches as the pseudoscience of invertebrate cosmetology, whatever that might mean. So this field didn't start off being very highly respected, although it did start with Dirac, which is obviously a very important figure in the physics of the 20th century. Of course, by now, varying constants are run-of-the-mill, at least some of them are, and specifically Brunsdicke theories, was shocked by Brunsdicke theories. Bekenstein proposed a varying electric charge, a varying alpha theory in 1982. I think all these dilaton theories basically mean that varying constants in some guises have become mainstream. In contrast, obviously, these two constants are sacred. So you don't touch those things, and you know why? Because they're structural. You touch those things and the building collapses. Now, you may not care about it, but you may end up homeless. So you have to know what to do about it. So this top, there was a lot of discussion of breaking diffeomorphism invariance and breaking Lorentz invariance. If you have a varying C, you guarantee to at least have some potential damage to Lorentz invariance. So to my mind, varying speed of light theories are a way to catalog, if you want, ways of violating Lorentz invariance, or at least some ways of violating Lorentz invariance. So some review. Obviously, there's some people here were pioneers. Obviously, there's quite a few varying C theories. I wrote a review a few years back. The point I'm trying to make here is that there really is, this is an umbrella term for quite a lot of things. You can find theories with variations in space-time in C, theories with energy dependence in C. You can find theories which don't break anything. They only break it spontaneously. Because if you're conservative like John Moffat, that's what you do. Or you can find completely crazy things like what I did with Andy Albrecht, in which you really break everything and you're really happy about it. Or you can find some things in the middle, which is like biometric theories, which you'll see, they're really quite cool things because they allow us to compute fluctuations and, you know, really, really get down to business, the serious business of being cosmologist. Some people here have worked in DSR as presumably a bridge between quantum gravity and phenomenology. To my mind, this is just one example of these theories in action. So generally speaking, historically, you have these two kinds of theories, variations in space-time and variations in energy associated with cosmology and quantum gravity. They might be connected, who knows. So the point is, really, there's a range, a whole range of things from lunacy to really boredom. And I'm going to start with the craziest possible one, just to give you a taste of it. And then I'll go into the most boring one, okay? And there's everything in between in this kind of game. Okay, so let's start with the lunatic corner. Okay, so what do you do if you want to break everything that moves, as I said? Well, in this case, I must say there's different ways. The philosophy, in a way, is quite obvious and very general. And some of the things I'm going to say may be a bit sketchy in some sense with respect to Ojava-Lifshitz, but in a way, the philosophy is very similar. And the idea, if you really insist on hard breaking of Lorentz invariance, this is the prescription. So take any preferred foliation. The universe is kind of waving. Yeah, take me as a preferred foliation. Apply a 3DM decomposition, and then mess it up in a way that makes sure that you cannot reconstitute the four-dimensional theory. Okay, it's very simple, and you can do this in many different ways. So why do we do this? As Nayashi said, if the universe breaks Lorentz invariance, we can as well. So this is one possible argument. There's a big flaw in this argument, the exercise for the student. And I'll mention it, and you know it, okay? But the basic idea is that the universe does give you something called the cosmological frame, and it is obvious that this frame does not need to partake into the formulation of the laws of physics, okay? And this is what happens in general relativity. You have solutions, Friedman solutions, which break, give you a preferred frame, but the equations themselves don't care about that. So you could actually rephrase everything in a different frame, make your life hell, compute everything in a different framework, the result would be the same, no problem at all. But if you actually want to break Lorentz invariance or foliation invariance, there is this candidate there begging to be used and to be folded into the laws of physics, which is why you can do it.
So, John, yeah. I guess the thing you said in the last transparency before this, so just mess up ADM. What I think a few of the talks early on mentioned that it's very hard to mess up with ADM because you have all this consistency and propagation of constraints. So it's not that you can do anything. I mean, you have to stick to some rules. Right?
You have to stick to some rules. I don't have to stick.
But you want to have a consistent equations, right?
It depends what you mean by consistent. I warned you already what consistency means is in the eye of the beholder, I think.
Really?
Yes. No, I think it's kind of, you'll see. So what I'm going to present, I did say this was the most sketchy thing. Okay. So I think Ojava Lifshitz is an example of that, in which you would argue it's completely consistent. And presumably what I'm about to do as well is something which you'd argue is completely inconsistent.
You have to wait and see.
You will see. So let me just give you examples and also draw the general conclusions of what happens. So some concrete examples of applying this possibly poisonous recipe. Yes, that's what you're saying. There may be some serious price to pay. It's obviously Ojava Lifshitz, and also what I did with Andy Albrecht very naively and very sketchily in like more than 10 years ago. So that's it, okay? Let's talk concrete things. So obviously you have all these parameters which are very concrete numbers if you start from the Einstein-Hilbert action and then just break it down. And if you change these parameters, which is what I mean, mess up the theory, you end up with something that cannot be reconstituted into like a four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariant structure, okay? So that's one example of doing things. The other one, and bear with me because I'm going to give you examples, is what we did more than 10 years ago, which is do the same thing, and then look at wherever you find a C. And then put a C of T in there, which is not a dynamical C of T, but is something which is non-dynamical and put in by hand, and which could be a phase transition in the early universe, could be some power law in the expansion factor. It's something which should stabilize nowadays. One thing you don't want, for me, consistency is consistency with experiment. One thing you don't want is say that the speed of light changed by a factor of 2 in the last 5 billion years. So we have to stabilize it, but as far as the early universe is concerned, who cares? Okay, because we've never been there, as Dirac pointed out.
If you take this to an extreme, you will not be able to make any predictions. You will only think.
I'll make predictions.
Okay.
Now there is a problem. This is going to be I'm going to say I'm going to show you a conservative thing and the crazy thing. The greatest weakness with this is exactly that it doesn't fix the C of T. It doesn't really do anything concrete. So you're right. I agree with you. Anything else?
I'm sorry. I don't see why you say that you can't put this back in a four-dimensional formalism. You have some new scalar field C which has some particular value. You just stick in a that defines your foliation, and everything is four-dimensional diffeomorphism.
The problem is that, for example, the Bianchi, you'll see this in action in a bit, but the Bianchi identity is, so what you find here is, for example, some of these equations are redundant. If you take dots of the constraint, you get some of the dynamical equations. The Bianchi identities create consistency conditions. When you do that, you end up with C dot over C terms, which screw up everything completely. Not only the Bianchi identities, or what you would call the Bianchi identities, but the conservation of stress energy tensor. So you do end up with something completely different, and which you could not actually have obtained from a four-dimensional theory.
Okay, I can. All I have to do is have a four-dimensional theory with a preferred time-like vector.
So it's very important to say this is not a dynamical field. Okay, something you put in my hand, that's the crucial thing about breaking Lorentz invariance or breaking diffeomorphism invariance. It's not a scalar field which dynamically is evolving. It's basically something slapped in by hand, and that's it. Okay, so what happens usually, and I'll show you this in action with the Friedman example, is, well, first of all, that's the thing, the equations of motion will actually look very different in a different frame. You'd acquire C dot over C terms and gradients of C if you change. So Nayashi, of course, you don't violate the Bianchi identities, but this thing I just said, this consistency condition is not going to be your traditional Bianchi identity. And as a result, your stress energy conservation is going to be screwed up. Why? Well, it's obvious you are, because you've broken time translational invariance in physics. You put a C of T in the laws. The L varies with T, not a theorem. Energy conservation results from that, so you shouldn't be surprised by that. Do we care? No, of course we don't care as long as this is done carefully in the sense of hiding things from obvious experimental contradiction. So, for example, Ojava Lifshitz, who cares if this happens at Planck scale and it helps quantizing gravity? And in this case, who cares if this happens in the very early universe and it helps to solve the Big Bang problems? So bear with me, this is obviously the point where you see the cosmological problems being addressed, and I agree with you, it's not the most predictive theory, and you'll see a better one in a minute. So this is a list of the cosmological problems that were bothering us at the time. And the horizon problem is the most obvious one, but there's a bunch of them. And what is funny about this thing is that you very obviously solve the horizon problem, but in addition you solve the others, except for structure formation, with these exactly with the same conditions, and that's what is non-trivial here. So that you solve the horizon problem is clearly like, you know, cosmologists in the pub have this idea. Okay, it's a completely obvious way to solve the horizon problem. What is the horizon problem? You take a moving region in the universe, you backtrack it, and this moving region contains more and more moving horizons as you backtrack it to the early universe. So you end up with this region in the early universe, this region in the early universe which cannot communicate, cannot explain homogeneity, cannot explain structure. You throw everything up in the air. So unless something breaks in this argument, you cannot solve the horizon problem. You can solve it by changing the rules of expansion. That's what inflation does. There you are, if after a few beers, very obviously, just open up the horizons, open up the light cones. And you find out that if your C of t was a phase transition at Planck time, a drop of at least 32 orders of magnitude in C would have solved the horizon problem. So nothing very deep, okay, it's just calculations in the pub. Well, this is what I think is content full in this statement. Let's go back to the statement I made about Noether's theorem, about breaking Lorentz invariance, diffeomorphism invariance, and energy conservation. So the flatness problem is the fact that you have a choice of universes. They can be critical, supercritical, or subcritical, closed, open, or flat. And this guy is cool, those guys are disastrous. You end up in a crunch, or you end up in an empty universe very quickly. And the flatness problem is the fact that any deviations from criticality just get bigger and bigger. So you have to fine-tune very carefully what happens in the early universe if you don't want to end up in disaster. Well, we don't like breaking violations of energy conservation. Well, this is the story you were asking, and the story you were asking too. So typically, if you take a dot of the first Friedmann equation compared with the second, you get the conservation equations. There's nothing but the usual trick of Bianchi identities implying conservation of energy. Well, play the trick with the C of t, and you find this really funny thing. The extra term is just the right sign to push it towards flatness. And I think this is cool. This is a nice result. What you find is that if you subcritical, you have an extra term for a dropping C, which takes away energy. If you subcritical, you create energy, and you end up with exactly the same condition for stabilizing the universe. Okay, so this is not exactly a prediction, but at least it's an interesting thing to point out.
So, what's the meaning of C? Is it an extra parameter in the metric?
It is the speed of propagation of the things.
So it's an extra parameter in the metric?
Yeah. Okay. But it's fixed. It's basically put in by hand. Like.
How do you mean fixed?
No, it's given. It's not a. It's not a. It's very important. It's very important to say it's not a dynamical field because then you haven't broken anything.
I know, but you are breaking your symmetry with other things as well. As long as it's a metric, you know, it's not flat. You are already doing that anyway.
Yeah.
So, but is this C that you are using? Is it? Do you treat it like a field? Do you vary with respect to it? So, what value do you take?
I do it specifically to break the diffeomorphism invariant. Why do you make lambda different from one in a Java Lifshitz? Well, there's other. The motivation is, of course, very different. But you might say, why are you doing that? Because I have nothing better to do. Okay, so
you could treat it as an additional field.
You could, but then you wouldn't do what I want to do, which is to break everything. Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, some consistency of equations may force you to treat it as a dynamical field.
No, but here you don't. The consistency equations is exactly what this is. The consistency equation.
The thing is that if you start adding perturbations, then you'll see also be pushed.
Okay, let me move on. So just a comment. This is crazy, but just an historical comment. Just to mention these, why varying speed of light theories? As far as I'm aware, the first varying speed of light theory proposed was by Einstein in 1911. Okay, so the man who invented the dogma, the sacred thing, was very happy to throw it out of the window. And the theory is completely crazy. It's crazier than this one. Okay, so don't worry. Of course, historians of science have pointed out, you're not going to hate me for this. He was in Prague when he did this theory, and it has been pointed out there might be some relation. But it is an interesting theory. It was basically proposing the build-up for GR, and he abandoned it. The motivation was very different, but in a way it was crazier than the stuff I've been doing. And the problem is that it had implications which were experimentally falsifiable now, here and now. Whereas this stuff is basically, you're sweeping all the garbage to the early universe. So you don't care. Okay, so this is the weaknesses of the approach. I quite agree with you. This is not very predictable, particularly when it comes to fluctuation. And this is the flaw in that beautiful argument. If the universe did it, why not do it ourselves? We only have a cosmological frame to zeroth order. As soon as you go beyond that, as soon as you go to fluctuations, what is the preferred frame? Is it the synchronous gauge? Is it the longitudinal gauge? Is it the whatever, the average curvature, whatever gauge, which you guys use, cosmologists never use? Suddenly you get the proliferation of choices, of possibilities, which makes this very ambiguous and very non-predictive. And to my mind, this is the main weakness. With this approach, I couldn't care less about the fact that this is crazy. So let's turn to the other end of the spectrum. I did promise to go from one end to the other. Let's be boring. And it is actually possible to break, to introduce a varying speed of light without doing any extreme damage to Lorentz invariants. And the only reason why I like it is not because I'm conservative or whatever, but because you can actually predict things better. So let me show you a bit about this. This is really the problem. The problem is not that universe has a horizon problem. The problem is not that the universe is homogeneous. The problem is that the universe is not homogeneous. In detail, the universe has fluctuations, and you better explain this. This is the holy grail. There's a lot of beer in this talk, I'm sorry. But there's the holy grail of physics at zeroth order, and then we'll talk about first orders and so on in a bit, is the following. If I take the curvature fluctuation in the Kamuvian gauge, I Fourier transform it, so this k is a Kamuvian k, and I compute this spectrum, which has a k cube in there, and which therefore is dimensionless when you work out the dimensions, you find that this thing can only be equal to a dimensionless amplitude, a square. And then if you want to have a function of k, for example, a power law, you must have a preferred k, just for dimensional reasons. So this is what scale invariance means. It doesn't mean conformal stuff. This is very simply what scale invariance means, and it's observed. We observe the following. If this ns is close to 1, so it's nearly scale invariant, and the amplitude is 10 to the minus 5. And if you have a theory, you better explain these facts or anything close to these facts. Otherwise, that's the end of your theory. Okay. So let me tell you a sensible theory of gravity with varying speed of light. So this is due to, again, to John Moffat, the conservative in residence here. So another one possible way to do things, which is quite interesting, is the bimetric approach. And this really doesn't violate anything explicitly. It's a very simple way to do things. Imagine I have a metric, which is I call the Einstein metric or the Einstein frame, with which I build the Einstein-Hilbert action. But then I minimally couple the matter frames to another metric, okay, g hat, which I call the matter frame. So nothing unusual. In fact, you've seen this before. This is in the case in which the two metrics are conformal. This is Brunsdicke theory. So if you have a conformal transformation between these two metrics driven by a dynamical field, that's basically a varying g theory. So a varying speed of light theory is nothing but the same thing in which this transformation is this formal. And what it means is that the light cones for gravity and the light cones for the massless matter fields are not coincident. In other words, the speed of light and the speed of the massless matter fields is different from the speed of the graviton in this theory. Okay, is anyone shocked by this? I shouldn't be shocked at anything, there's nothing wrong with this. Problem now is, what is the minimal VSL theory? So it's obviously something of this sort, in which this B should be a constant. I'll comment on what happens if it isn't. And then the ambiguity here, the thing which you might think is not very predictive, is exactly how do you define the dynamics of this extra field? So this could be Klein-Gordon, for example, in the matter frame. It could be Klein-Gordon in the Einstein frame. And there's a very simple technical thing, which is if I postulate a Klein-Gordon Lagrangian here, I actually don't get the Klein-Gordon equation in this frame. There's a technical aspect here. There's basically three options, and you have to play with them until you find what is the minimum, what really is the minimum bimetric VSL theory. So very simple, let's go back now to the focus of this talk. What kind of fluctuations do you get in these theories? So this is obviously not a very simple calculation, but fortunately this was done for us by some people. So it turns out that if you project everything into the Einstein frame, this ends up being inflation, but with a varying speed of sound, which is something which, if you work on inflation, K-essence inflation, is of course like book stuff, textbook stuff by now. So kappa essence or K-essence is basically an inflationary version of the theory with non-quadratic terms, and this is your toolbox. Your toolbox is, this is what cosmologists need to know. What's the pressure? What's the density? And what's the speed of sound? So the usual inflation, this guy is just x, so this is 1. The speed of the graviton, the speed of sound, the acoustic speed in the inflaton is the speed of light. And if you V dominated, you have P equals minus V. But in general, it could be something else. For example, this guy came up with a crazy theory called the cascaton. The speed of sound is infinite. Well, what happens is that the K is proportional to the square root of X, and you get infinity here, because the denominator is 0.
You have misspelled the cascaton.
How do you spell it?
I'm not going to
tell you. You know, cascaton.
Two U's in it.
Two U's? Who came up with such a stupid name? I know it was your wife, okay? So.
that's
is she here? Okay.
It's even worse. Like, go ahead.
It's even worse than what? It was not your wife?
No. that you say that, then she's done. Yeah.
So anyway, this formalism is quite powerful and allows you to study quite a lot of fluctuations in many theories. As I said, it was invented for completely different reasons for kappa essence theories. Here's how you compute the fluctuation. So someone who does work for you, this is a nightmare. You basically fluctuate, you expand to second order, blah, blah, blah. It's a nightmare for calculation, but the final answer is very simple. So your curvature fluctuation should go into a variable V, where the Z which appears there contains now the speed of sound, given by the formula I gave you. And then your equation is actually, it's just a harmonic oscillator with a varying mass, which is tachyonic, okay? That's basically what comes out of cosmological perturbation theory. You have these two terms. One is just a harmonic oscillator. One is a mass term, which is negative. Mass square is negative. That's the wrong sign. So cosmological perturbation theory, this thing about generating those fluctuations is nothing but a game, a juggling game between these two guys. If the first one wins, you just have oscillations. You're inside the horizon. You have acoustic waves. The second one wins, you have an instability. So don't worry about the mass square being negative. That guy hates it. I don't know. It's called gravitational instability. We would not be here if this didn't exist. Okay? If the modes get out of the horizon, gravity wins. And if things clump, gravity makes it clump more. If things rarefy, gravity makes it rarefy more. You have an instability which causes growth of fluctuation. So what is the horizon problem, really? The horizon problem is that if you take a normal universe in which the speed of sound is 1 or whatever, it's a constant, and you don't break the strong energy condition, this guy dominates initially. Because conformal time grows from 0, so this guy is actually divergent, and you start outside the horizon. So we have no idea how to set initial conditions. There have been some proposals. But certainly, if you're not inside the horizon, you don't know how to set initial conditions for your fluctuation. Inflation solves the problem in this way. This is the way you pull the bunny out of the hat. What you do is the following. You break this condition, therefore conformal time becomes negative, and it grows to 0. So you actually start inside the horizon, and then you leave the horizon later. Okay? Very simple way to invert the timing. All of this game is cookery, I said the other day to someone. It's true. You're basically cooking, and your cooking timing between the term 1 and term 2 is what determines everything. So scaling invariance is what is actually not obvious here, and you have to be near the sitter. So there's a general law which tells you that if you play this trick, scaling invariance is associated with being close to the sitter. And the calculation is very simple, very naive, very a la cosmologist. I can see people cringing already. What you do is you normalize your modes, your oscillation modes, with this square root of 2k in quantum field theory, which render these amplitudes creation and annihilation operators. You find the vacuum expectation value. Notice this now. If you solve this in the sitter, these guys start off like 1 over square root of k, so they're not scaling invariant. Inside the horizon, your fluctuations go like 1 over k. But then this is the miracle of the sitter. As you leave the horizon, you pick up this extra factor, and you become scaling invariant. Okay, so there's a universal law in this kind of mechanism, which is if you near the sitter, you get scale invariance. In the sense I defined, which is not the sense you were playing with words yesterday. Okay?
How do you know how I spend
it? Okay, so let me tell you how to do this with the varying speed of sound. So what is the equivalent thing if you have a mechanism like the one I mentioned? Okay, so in this case, obviously, you could mix inflation and varying speed of light, but let's not do the two things, okay? We don't want soup and chocolate mousse together, okay? So let's keep this guy as he was. So this guy still goes like 1 over eta square, but let's make the speed of sound drop in a way that it dominates earlier, okay? So this is the way to solve. You find the condition for solving the horizon problem so that the first term dominates first and then the second. And now the same question arises. How do you get scale invariance? Well, you go through the calculation, same story, you solve, and here's a remarkable result. This is what appears to be the case. Whatever the equation of state, this is completely universal, you find that if the speed of sound goes like the density of the universe, you end up with scale invariance. So it's a remarkable result, and the implication is quite interesting. This is just for experts. Anyone who's done k-essence will know this formula. So in inflation, in k-essence inflation, you play with the speed of sound because you want to change the ratio between tensors and scalars, yes? So because you are a conservative person who cannot imagine speeds bigger than the speed of light, you make the speed of sound small, so you bump up the scalars, so you change the scalar to tensor ratio, okay? This is the trick everyone works in k-essence knows. You can see if CS is proportional to rho, this becomes a constant. Okay, so it's the same thing, and you immediately know the reason why this general law works. As I said, you don't want the speed of light to be changing by a factor of 2 in the last 5 billion years, so you want this to be cut off at some point. Here's where 10 to the minus 5 comes in. So at some point, what you want is your C to be not proportional to rho, but some expression like this, in which when rho is very small, like nowadays, you enter plateau, you enter this plateau in C, and things don't change. Turns out that your amplitude is actually the ratio between this density and the Planck mass. Okay, so two very important things. So universal law, and this is where the amplitude comes from. Okay, so what's the minimal bimetric theory? This is what I think is really cool. At this point, we've just been playing a la cosmologist with scale invariance. Yeah?
Actually, there are no changes in such models.
Yeah, I will talk about that if I have the time. Okay. So this is for non-experts. You're obviously an expert. And I will be talking to you about that. I will have 5 minutes in the end about this, if I have the time. Okay, so let me just show you this. Yeah, someone?
The speed of the light changed by the density, what would happen in the neutron star? It would change the physics of the neutron star.
So this is why I don't want the speed of light to be varying wildly nowadays, okay? I mean, things like the millisecond pulsar, all these kinds of things give me a lot of problems, okay? So, you know, this variation, C proportional to rho, is only when rho is much bigger than basically 10 density 10 minus 10 of the Planck mass to the fourth. So then you level off, and in the last 5 billion years, the C is basically constant. Yeah?
Somehow you need this to be non-adiabatic, in a sense that pressure cannot be a function of rho.
This is adiabatic.
No, but I mean, pressure is inside the horizon, pressure is not a function of rho.
Yes.
It is? So you
mean the background equation of state?
No, yeah. Even the fluctuation, so it's like inside the horizon. So can I just integrate this equation and say P should go as rho cubed?
No.
Why not?
So be very careful, this is not a fluid.
That's what I'm asking.
It is not a fluid. As you can see, you can't do that here.
Yeah, so CSS squared is that dp by d rho. Yeah.
You can try and do this with the fluid. You can do it adiabatically, but then the trick is different. I did that with Johannes, actually. So. Okay, so what kind of bimetric theory does this? Okay, let me just show you this. I was very surprised by this result. So what is this minimal bimetric theory? So look at this, okay? So as John Moffat found ages ago, if you put a Klein-Gordon a Lagrangian here, you don't actually get a Klein-Gordon in the matter frame. And the answer is, it's a technicality, but if you want to get Klein-Gordon dynamics in the matter frame, it's enough to have a cosmological constant in the matter frame. So it's a non-obvious thing, but it's a very nice result. Klein-Gordon minimal dynamics in the matter frame corresponds in terms of action principles to just a cosmological constant in the matter frame. And now you play this trick, okay? You just a simple exercise with determinants. What happens when I project this onto the Einstein frame? Which is where the calculations of kappa essence are made. And you end up with this, okay? Kaskaton, asymptotically, Born-Hinfeld, in fact, but with the wrong sign. So if I want to have a speed of light bigger than the speed of sound, I have something like a DBI model, but with the wrong sign. So this is interesting. It looks, basically, this is what you find. You have this model in which the minimal model should actually be just a cosmological constant with this signature, a positive lambda in the Einstein frame, balanced by a negative lambda in the matter frame, which gives you this model. So DBI with the wrong sign, asymptotically Kaskaton, speed of sound going to infinity. So what is actually the speed of sound here? Well, this is my toolbox I gave you before. Work it out. This is what you get. So very interesting. The thing which, just as a cosmologist, I worked out as the universal law associated with scale invariance, CS proportional to rho, is actually realized by the minimal model. The minimal bimetric model is the one I just mentioned. And this is the conclusion. It's possible to identify not only the universal law associated with scale invariance, but this law is realized by what in the Einstein frame looks like an anti-DBI model, which is actually the minimal bimetric model. So a pretty cool result. I was very surprised by this, and I was very happy with this.
It seems to me when you expand the square root, you will have a kinetic energy with the wrong sign.
No.
And you don't have a ghost here?
No. So sign, be careful with that guy. So any questions about the, I still have five. What I want to do now, this was kind of, for people who obviously are cosmologists, this was probably very obvious.
But obvious.
It wasn't.
So my question is,
okay.
You need
you're not a proper cosmologist.
No, I'm not. So the potential, does that also follow from your construction from Born-Hinfeld or not?
That's right. Your potential, and you found this, you should know this, to get constant W solutions, you need a mass potential.
Okay, so that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
So you have
yep.
to put it by hand.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, that
that's
doesn't
right.
follow from Born-Hinfeld.
No, it's basically this potential, which I put in there, that potential there.
You have to put it.
So it's Born-Hinfeld plus a mass potential, not because of the speed of sound, which is what I was concentrating on, but because you want the background to be a constant W, and then you need it. Come on, you found this, you should know that. Okay, so let me just
something cool. So this potential in the limit of infinite speed of sound, this becomes lambda equal to one third that Renata talked about in the first day.
Right.
So
right.
There is some. So it's, see, the lambda goes from one third to one in a funny way. It's, yeah.
How long have I got? Given that everyone has been interrupting me so rudely.
15 minutes.
Yes. Okay, excellent.
But that includes
discussions. So I want to just spend, as I said, this was meant to be like a general pedagogic thing. And now I'm expert, so you ask this question, I'm going to answer it. So this is like, you have to look like this guy from now on, can go to sleep. So what I'm going to be doing now is trying to give you some more technical, this is more technical now, but for cosmologists, let's go beyond the zeroth order. So two things. What if it's not scale invariant? And what about the non-Gaussianity? So very important issues, which are very topical now. And some of us here are enthusiasts of something called DSR. Could this be realized by DSR? So I'll be telling you a few things about this in the remaining time. I'll try to spend only 5-10 minutes, not more, 5 minutes. So I said the zeroth order holy grail is scale invariance. What about beyond that? Well, it's basically 0.96. You could still live with one if you really pushed it. But it looks like that, you know, it's going to be nearly scale invariant, not exactly scale invariant. How would you realize that in inflation? How would you realize that here? Well, it's a very simple answer in the case of these biometric models. It turns out that it's enough to make this B a power law to end up with the spectral index. And you work it out, and there's actually a formula which gives you the spectral index as a function of the power you should put in that coupling. So you might think at this point, I was actually a bit disappointed. I was quite happy to spend by n equals 1 and die with it, okay? But in the end, okay, this is, it's a very simple modification, and it does give you a spectra which are not exactly scale invariant. And then why did I like, I didn't like that because it looked like it was like inflation, the theory of anything. Give me any prediction, inflation can predict it. Give me any observation, inflation go for it. And I didn't like that here. It looked like you could predict any spectral index, except that there is this very interesting fact. If you compute a non-Gaussianity, you end up with a consistency relation. So what I said about inflation was a bit rude, and it was not even completely fair. There is a thing called consistency conditions in inflation, which relate, for example, the spectral index and the amount of tensor modes and things like that. The equivalent thing here is quite different because we don't have tensor modes. We did not solve the horizon problem for the graviton. We solved it for the matter. We have scalar modes. We don't have gravitons here. So one of the predictions of the theory is that there's no tensor modes. But you also have a consistency relation. So we can actually go beyond scale invariance. But this is what happened. So this is the three-point function, the bispectrum. As you know, this thing ends up with this factor here, A. And now you might ask the question, what is the non-Gaussianity for these models?
Sorry, just a question. So why do you say here that you don't have tensor modes?
No.
Why?
Because you haven't solved your, because for tensors in the Einstein frame, you're always outside the horizon. So it's only the scalar modes, the matter modes, that have this property of varying speed of sound. So there's no tensor modes. So any chance of a consistency relation has to go somewhere else, and this is where I go to look for it. Okay, so first of all, what is the bispectrum if I have the minimal model? So if I have the minimal model, I find the equilateral shape, just like in DBI models, okay? So there's nothing unusual about this. You end up with something. This is your amplitude. Already here, there is a distinguishing factor. So you find that for my basic n equals 1 model, the FNL is actually quite different from DBI inflation and from standard inflation. I have an equilateral shape, but the FNL for a normal inflation is 0.1. For DBI inflation is minus 100. So I end up with something order 1, but positive. So quite distinct. Interesting. What I think is really predictive is this, okay? So we work out what happens when that B is a power law, which gives me a tilted spectrum, not a scale invariant spectrum. So it's a long calculation, very nasty, but you end up with this correction. So we have equilateral shape, and then all these corrections, which are not equilateral, and they go like NS minus 1. So this is the answer to your question. We have a consistency relation between NS and the shape of the bispectrum. And look at this guy, there's actually a small collapsed component which goes like NS minus 1, and like in the usual theory. So I quite like this. This is the prediction. You can see that the collapse, the guy in here, for example, grossly exaggerated for NS equals 0.96. The theory is predictive. It's different from inflation, and it's predictive. You can shoot at it, okay? This is what is cool about these things. You can go there and you can just, I mean, this theory is very, there you are. You want something predictive, you sleep, thank you. You want something predictive, there you are, you do get it. I did say this was for experts, so you're allowed to sleep. Okay, the other experts, DSR. Can this be realized by DSR?
Okay, if I may.
Yeah.
So, is this different from Mother-Senna's consistency condition?
What is the Mother-Senna's consistency?
It's exactly that, I think. It's just that, this is the squeeze limit of bispectrum, right?
This is
NS-1.
This is the general shape. No, this is one up. Yeah, the squeeze limit, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Mother-Senna's consistency is just that, is NS-1 times the product of the power spectrum. So
it's a bit different. I mean, the point here is not this. The point is that, right?
That's what you said is a constraint.
I mean, the top one is a constraint. And the really cool thing here is I have not added more parameters. I have more observables. But I only have one extra parameter, which gives me the NS and the shape of the bispectrum. Okay? Yeah?
Sorry, I'm confused here. You did the equation for the equilateral or the squeeze limit?
This is the general. This is in the squeeze limit I get
this
result. But this is general.
This is the general.
Yeah.
I see.
And this is the plotting of it.
So usually, in the usual or the standard implementation, usually we have FNL for the equilateral much bigger than the squeeze limit.
Yeah.
So what about
here? Here depends on the spectral index. So you measure, that's the point. You have the data, you have an extra parameter, and you have to fit the shape of the spectrum and the spectral index together.
I see.
So we have one extra parameter but more observables. I see. I think is good. Okay, DSR, let's go for it. Okay. Can this be, DSR is a weird thing. DSR is basically So middle ground between quantum gravity and phenomenology. That's what people say. I'm not sure this has worked that way. But anyway, some people are enthusiasts, and I am one as well. Okay. But basically, what happens is you think that the form dispersion relations are this point in which you meet, and effectively, what you try to do is come up with a theory which does not have a preferred frame, does not violate the principle of relativity, but which has non-quadratic dispersion relations. And this can be done. Some people do it non-commutative geometry. Some people do it with non-linear realizations of the Lorentz group. But there is one way to realize the principle of relativity and non-quadratic dispersion relations, hoping that these departures from the quadratic dispersion relations encode the effects of quantum gravity. And there's some evidence that you do end up with some dispersion relations from quantum gravity. Now, what's interesting here is that there's going to be some caveats here, and the main one being that we don't know how to couple the SR to gravity, or rather we have some options, but we're not completely sure about that. But let me kind of do the following trick. Let's imagine that I have some mechanism, and this is the reason, if I have dispersion relations which only affect the momentum, I can actually juggle things around and claim that gravity doesn't care about it. Okay, there's one way to prove that. This can be converted into a field theory that you only have extra gradients, special gradients. And now let's try and reproduce the calculation done in cosmology. Okay, so you might think that because you have dispersion relations which are not quadratic, you have a speed of light that depends on the energy, therefore it's not time dependent. But here's the trick. Okay, the k, maybe I did not emphasize this enough, but the k which appears there is a commoving k. So what you do in cosmology is you fix a given k and then you follow it, and it expands with the universe like A. So the physical k is actually increasing, rather the wavelength is increasing, which means you're actually scanning your dispersion relations in time as you focus on a given commoving k and you wait through time. So you can actually, by proxy, end up with a theory in which the speed of sound is time dependent, even if originally, fundamentally, it's only an energy dependence what you have. Okay, I don't want to spend too long on these, but here's the answer. You go through these, here's the dispersion relation, it turns out to be universal. Again, does not depend on the equation of state. It's completely universal, and it turns out that this is the dispersion relation which leads to scale invariance. So yet again, there is a parameter here which cuts it off at low energy. That gives you the 10 to the minus 5. But it looks like omega proportional to k cubed is the thing that gives you scale invariance using this trick, which is, I think, z equals 3, isn't it? So that's quite in, and I have no idea. And I have no idea what this means because for you, of course, it's a dispersion relation for the gravity. Whereas, this, in a way, the idea to realize this here.
No, it just means that for z equal 3 in 3 dimensions, you get a log propagator for the scalar and for other fields as well. That explains that why you get an independence of the scale from the scale.
Maybe you should talk after this. Okay.
No, but I mean, we don't. I think. Peter has written the theory for for the metric, but I mean the scalar, whether you need to add extra terms for the scalar, like hard derivatives of log n, you want the same dispersion relation for the scalar that you have for the metric. Then. Yeah.
Or you could have a matter scalar on top of the gravity model, just conventional rigid scalars, let's say for 3 in dB, and then they would have a log propagator.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
I'm just saying you hadn't written them explicitly.
They were written explicitly somewhere in the second.
Okay. Okay, so let me, in fact, finish. Basically, the moral is breaking Lorentz invariance is good for you. If you're a cosmologist, it appears. It does provide you with an alternative to inflation for solving the cosmological problems, particularly if you're not too crazy and you settle for biometric theories. It is observationally distinct from inflation. There's some interesting aspects of the story which I think remain to be explored, like the SR and the connection with Ojeda-Lifshitz and a few others. So, of course, the question, this is good for you, but are you ready to take the plunge? I'm not sure. I'd just like to point out the first time a varying speed of light was investigated, it was in 1874. I was in Belfast before I came here. Kelvin is from Belfast. So there was no one got shocked with this back then. then 1905 came, and look at this stupid thing. Unbelievable. Eddington in 1930 made this statement, a variation in C is self-contradictory, which raises all kinds of sociological issues. I mean, was physics self-contradictory before 1905? Because he's implying that, right? Is the constancy of C, is Lorentz invariance a matter for logic or a matter for experiment? And I don't think it's a matter for logic, which is basically the implication. It's a matter for experiment. Relativity was a reaction to Maxwell's theory, not only the Michelson-Morley experiment, but the whole body of data behind Maxwell's theory. Of course, nowadays, the formalism has had the constancy ingrained in it so much that the mathematics makes you think it's contradictory. But this is my favorite quote by Einstein. Since mathematicians invaded relativity, I don't understand it myself anymore. And I think, in a way, that's been the problem. The way we write equations, in a way, is basically taking for granted something, which really is an experimental fact. And I hope to show you that I have showed you that cosmology could settle that. Because once you realize that the constancy is an observational fact, there's always this, another of my favorite quotes, the Hertz quote, what is due to experiment may always be rectified by experiment. I'll stop here. Scale of what?
What range of scale invariant modes can you get with the variance to the sound?
Well, what range of scale invariant? Well, exactly, you get the whole thing. There's no such a thing as an infold in here, right?
Well, how many decades of modes?
Don't think that way, because you get them all, basically. So it's not like inflation. There's no trans-Planckian problem, because you go all the way into it, in a way.
So you don't.
It's not like inflation, which you have a beginning of inflation and an end of inflation. The thing always happens, and then basically just levels off into the tenth, you know, the row zero, the row where equals row.
So did you get a chance to read the paper by Justin Curry and Austin Joyce last year on varying sound speed models?
Yes, I did.
So what's your response to that?
It's a different model, right? It is a very different model. Now, here you generate basically everything from very large to very small. There's no such thing as chaotic inflation or anything. So you actually generate very clearly all the modes you need. So there's no such thing as infoldings, right? I mean, you don't have reheating. You don't have, like, enough inflation and reheating. What you have is just basically, if you believe this prescription all the way up to